Viper. Tuesday, 13th of April.
Robert, this is about 10 seconds. Gar left before he made the record, and after him, Money follows.
Here I am. In Epworth Hospital, just off Punt Road in Melbourne. Well, Robert, I've been talking to you for a good 20 minutes or more, chatting about this, that, and the other. I did try out that first sentence, and so I thought everything was being recorded correctly, but by the time I let it run on for about 20 minutes, then ran it back a bit and played it again, found there was absolutely nothing beyond that first sentence on the tape. Now, what the hell I've done or been doing, I don't know. So I'll have to start again, but I'll just stop for a second and play this back to see whether this is coming out. Well, here goes again. I think I've got it right this time. I started off to tell you at the very beginning, and although I said the first sentence did come out, but only a little bit of it came out. I'm in Epworth Hospital, not for any serious illness, but because I have been rather off colour generally for quite some months. It really began when I was up in service last September, and I ate some shellfish or other there that disagreed with me rather violently, and although one usually gets over a thing like that in a day or two, it seemed to stem and start from there, and I had a series of tummy aches and a general feeling of malaise and weakness and so on, running over quite a period. Our very meticulous little friend Ernie Kersner visited me time and time again. He gave me all sorts of medical treatment and medicaments and so forth, and I didn't seem to be able to get very far with my problems, and this went on for quite a few months. Finally, in a sort of desperation, he sent me to a very famous stomach surgeon here to see if I had any suggestive trouble there in my tummy, and I had to go through a rather nasty experience of examination there, and with a barring a minima subsequently and so on, and the reply came out, the report came out, everything's okay in this direction, so that was settled. Then he kept on visiting me and prescribing and so on. Finally I said to him, look here, Ernie, do you think you could put me onto a really good diagnostic physician? We get another opinion and see what can be. It's a very good idea, Ernie. He put me down to our old friend Morris Davis, who have your mother in this hospital for a week or so at one time, probably before you went away. He was Nanny's physician, and she swore by him, as do good men, actually thousands of others all over Australia. He was a very high reputation, rather peculiar chap in many ways, and a lot of people just can't put up with his somewhat peculiarities. But I've always felt he's a very outstanding man, and other doctors have told me that there is not a solitary consulting diagnostician physician in Melbourne that can equal him. So he put me here, for 10 days. I've been here for 7. I'm going home in a day or two. I think I'm feeling better. I'm fairly sure I'm feeling a bit better, but he says I'll be a lot better. And when he's finished pouring a lot of vitamins into me by way of mouth and pills and pastilles and injections and so on, he feels that I'll get a great benefit out of it. So maybe I will, and I hope I will, of course, and I'll be home in a day or two's time, and that'll be the end of it. Well, the place is very nice. It's an old-fashioned place, and a huge big veranda right outside of my bedroom, a very wide and long veranda facing the east, overlooking away out over the ranges. And fortunately, we've had the most glorious autumn weather that I ever can remember. And the sun has been streaming in here every morning, and I've been able to get out in the veranda and walk up and down in the most glorious sunshine each day since I've been here. So now that's the end of that as far as I'm concerned, and get on to some other topic. I played that last bit over down to a topic, and it came out all right. Starts off again, and I didn't go very far, and I thought I'd just try it, and again there was nothing there. it's a simple matter to put the middle key and the red key down, but again, I think when I started over a second time, I didn't put the both keys down. This time I've done it correctly, and it should be the last time that I make a silly faux pas, but you just have to put it down to a senility in old age, and that's all there is to it. Now I listened to your tape. Before I started to put this on, the tape that arrived, I think, only yesterday at home, and your father brought it in to me this morning. It's very interesting. I mean, you talked about you came down to London and you strolled around through London and the streets that you mentioned, a number of which I could well visualise and remember, and Tate Gallery and various places you went to have a look at, And altogether, it was quite interesting chat, which I sitting here thoroughly enjoyed. In the middle of it, Roy Iles came in, and I said, "Would you like to hear some of Robert's chatter around London?" And he said, "Yes." And then we both listened for a few minutes, and I turned it off and had a yarn to him and thanked him for coming in, and then I finished it off a little later.
There was a photograph, some photographs came a few days ago that I saw at your place, of you and Penny Gold. You of course look quite different to what I remember you with your hair and moustache and so on. And Penny looks a very charming sort of person, but we've heard very little about her, and although you have it on quite a few occasions mentioned her in your tapes. I remember one tape where you told us that you and she went up to London, and that her father had been in hospital, and that he was pretty seriously ill, and that possibly the outlook ahead was not terribly promising. And I don't know of any other, I can't remember any other, I can't remember any other incidents that, you've told us. I'm quite interested in hearing a little more about Penny and her background and what she's doing, what course she's doing at Cambridge, and any other matters you care to tell us, because apparently it seemed pretty apparent that you're both get on very well together and very good friends and enjoy each other's company. Anyway, if you care to, we'll be very glad to hear about her further from you. She looks a very charming personality, and I was able to see in the photograph as if she has a very considerable amount of personality. I was very interested, Robert, in that tape that you were good enough to send me some little time ago from Louis the Belgian. Now, I feel that Louis, with his pretty intimate knowledge by now of the inner workings of affairs in Israel, must be seriously considered when he says that that Israel must accept the peace offer and must barter land and security in the hope that the offer will be a genuine one. It is a terrific gamble for Israel to take, because if they draw right back to the lines of the of the armistice lines, they're in a shockingly vulnerable position, and could, with the huge amount of sophisticated weapons that Russia has supplied to Egypt, be wiped out, stock and barrel, almost overnight. But still, they have to take the gamble, according to Louis, and I think there's a good deal. Even you see a famous Ben-Gurion stated the other day that Israel should give up and withdraw to all the territory, with the exception of the Golan Heights, the Straits of Tehran, and Jerusalem itself, the first two being so essentially necessary for self-preservation, and Jerusalem itself for other reasons, although a deal could be arranged there for making it a multinational city. Now, of course, I well remember when I was in Israel with Nanny 10 years ago, we went to the Sea of Galilee. Actually, the man and his wife, who there was a Melbourne couple with us in the car, and the man and I went and put on our swimsuit and bathed in the Sea of Galilee, and the Nanny and the other lady stayed in the bank or in the car, and right above us was the Golan Heights, way up high, and the artillery placed there controlled the whole of that plain for miles, and with long-range sophisticated artillery up there, nothing could possibly live for miles around that couldn't be shelled with impunity and all the inhabitants killed. And it's pretty evident that particular section, which was one of such a terrific cost of life to the Israelis in the 67 war, must be retained as a safety point for the future. However, his whole talk with you and your questions you drew from him were, I thought, very well put and excellently answered, and the summing up, while it's pretty drastic, I suppose, with perhaps some minor modifications, will have to be the final issue in this matter. I'm here under the medical direction of Dr. Morris Davis. I don't remember if I mentioned that earlier on in this tape. I certainly did mention it in the part that was not recorded. And he, of course, is the man, if you remember, that put your mother into this hospital a short period, I think, before you went away. He also was Nanny's medical advisor, and she had tremendous faith in him, and he has a tremendous reputation throughout the whole of Australia. By the way, Robert, did you hear the story about the lady who invited the Padre to come to Sunday's luncheon? And when he duly arrived, little Mr. 6 or 7 year old said, "Oh, goodness." And the Padre said, "Hello, Sonny, why do you say that?" He said, "Oh, you look like a man." He said, "Well, my dear boy, I am a man." And the youngster said, "Oh, I heard Mother telling Mrs. Brown you were a real old woman." Well, I don't know how much of this side of the tape's left. I find it rather difficult to tell by looking at the sprockets. There was another good story that you might care to hear about a well-known psychologist who interviewing a Roman Catholic priest, Anglican parson, and a rabbi, and he said, "Now, you chaps, I want to ask you a question. If you were told by a very eminent medical authority that you only had 6 months to live, what would you do?" So he said, "Padre, what would you do?" So the Padre said, he said to the priest first, "What would you do, Father?" And he said, "Well, Big Gary, should I think there's only one thing, and my first thought would be to prepare myself to meet my Maker. And after I'd done the best I could there, I would spend the rest of the short time available to me in trying to alleviate the conditions and help people around me." "Oh, very good," he said. And said to the Anglican parson, he said, "Now, what would you do if you only had the 6 months to go?" And he said, "Well, I've listened carefully to Father Flaherty here, and I can't possibly think of anything better or anything to add to what he said. The first thought that flies to my mind, prepare myself to meet my Maker. And for the rest, what he said is exactly what I think I would do myself. I can't see any other alternative or answer to your question." So we turned to the rabbi. He said, "Rabbi, if a very eminent medical authority told you you had only 6 months to live, what would you do?" Well, he said, "Immediately I'd call or request a second opinion." Your mother, with her usual kind thought, and perspicacity handed me a little book to read when I came into the hospital. I thanked her and I thought, oh well, I might read it, the odds are I'll take it home and I won't feel much like reading here. But I did open it and I did read it, and it's called The Watcher on the Cast Iron Balcony by a chap called Hal Porter, who's written quite a bit of stuff in Australia, and who is it's his autobiography from when he's a little boy up to the time he's about in his middle 20s. I might say that I've told you all this on the tape earlier. I'm pretty certain it was on the part that did not come out. If you haven't read it, it's worth getting hold of, I think, because he gives his life and his impressions of his first few years of life in a crowded Melbourne inner suburb, and then his father gets a job down in Bensdale, and the whole family moved down there, and they have a small house, and he lives there, goes to school at the high school until he's about 16, and then he has to go out and earn some money and gets a job on the local Bensdale Advertiser as a cub reporter, and then decides he wants to go to the big smoke and go to Melbourne and have a look around. But in the meantime, he's offered a job as a school teacher at the high school, and he accepts it, and then he gets transferred to the Williamstown High a year later, and his life there, and pretty crude experiences he has to go through, and so on. It's quite an interesting book, and I told Jonathan about it, and he said yes, he'd heard quite a bit about it. He got a copy, and of course, being right down on the spot himself, and being at the high school, and being at the Williamstown High, is rather a coincidence. Because he spends quite a bit of time telling you about Williamstown in the early years of the century, and anyway, I found it quite an interesting book, and if you can pick up a copy, it's Faber edition. Faber of 29 Russell Square, London, WC1, 24 Russell Square are the publishers. Well, I'm going to sign off now, Robert. I'm not feeling terribly 100% this morning, and there were quite a few other things I was going to talk about, but I'll have to leave them to another time. So cheerio, old chap. All the best, and I hope you can make out this Ola Podrida of mine. You know, Robert, the thought just occurs to me that if you could persuade Penny to just say a few words or sentences to us on one of your tapes when you're making it, it'd be a very nice and charming way in which we could sort of introduce ourselves to each other and hear a few words from her, which we in turn at this end would reply to. Just a thought, and possibly you may think so, you and she may decide to do something about it.